Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, JP Beatification. Who's coming and why? We speak to one of the main organisers of the upcoming beatification of the late Pope John Paul to find out the answers. Papal bestseller. With Pope Benedict's latest book on Jesus of Nazareth climbing to the number 5 spot on the New York Times bestseller list, we examine why it's proving so popular among such a wide range of readers and explore some of the book's fresh perspectives. Journey of Faith. Two people who are about to be formally received into the Church at the Easter Vigil this year share their stories with us about why they were drawn to Catholicism and how it has changed their life. And overindulging. In the latest of his Lenten reflections, Scottish Jesuit priest Father Chris Bowles, as a self-confessed overeater, ponders on how we can curb our appetites during this season of fasting.
Do not be afraid.
Nobody knows the exact number, but church organisers expect hundreds of thousands of pilgrims to flood into the city of Rome for the beatification ceremony of the beloved late Pope John Paul on Sunday, May the 1st. But where are these pilgrims mostly coming from? Are they young or old? And what are some of their personal reasons for wanting to be there? And are there still reasonably priced hotel rooms up for grabs in Rome during the beatification weekend? To find out the answers to these and other questions, I spoke to Father Cesare Attuire, the manager at Opera Romana Pellegrinaggi, the Vatican institution in charge of organising the logistics for the beatification events.
Well, I must say there's quite a variegated group. On the one hand, there are many young people, but I'm not talking of teenagers, because at the end of the day, the teenagers today remember very little about John Paul II. So we're talking about young people, but we're talking of people from 18 to 40, if that's the category of young people. And we also have, people who are above 60, and above all, people who are sort of like devout to the church, and people who are practicing Catholics. Those are the type of people we're receiving, and we're also getting a number of families that are coming along. Like a whole family that want to take part in these celebrations.
Now, of any of the stories that you heard of the reasons that people give for coming, are there any that stood out in your mind, particularly memorable, particularly striking reasons why they're coming, because of their link with Pope John Paul?
Well, we have quite a number, but just think of a young lady now who wants to be to come for the beatification because she remembers that when she was a kid, during a papal audience, when she was still a baby, the Pope passed by and basically sort of like lifted her up and kissed her while she was still a baby, and she has the photographs. And now this person is over 20 years old and says, I cannot be absent, I cannot miss this moment, I have to come for this beatification. So there are very personal motives for coming for the beatification.
Do you predict a last minute rush of people who might come, particularly as they're saying now that there's not so many people, possibly as many people were thinking at the beginning?
Absolutely. This is quite normal for this type of event. Usually what tends to happen is this like a bit of an emotional surge, let's call it that way, towards the very last few days. And I think this is what is going to happen. That's why I said our organization is extremely modular, and we're going to be monitoring the situation, and it will increase the organizational capacity as we get near the days of the beatification.
And are there still a lot of hotel rooms available, particularly, should we say, in the more economical side?
Absolutely. We even have a camping area, which is almost free. The idea is to make sure that people can actually come at relatively economic, cheap prices. Even some of the airlines are beginning to offer us now good services and good rates for people to be able to find flights to come to Rome.
Now, I was told that it's mostly Italians coming, and then after that, Poles, and then Spanish and the US. Can you break that down into a ratio?
Gosh, it's a bit difficult to do so. I suppose, Italians will be more than 50% normally. That's what usually happens. And, of course, if we have about 30% or 25% coming from Poland, then we have some 10 or so from, let's say, 10 to 12 from the English-speaking world. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, we're talking of England, we're talking of Ireland, Scotland, and the United States. And, of course, I mean, the interesting thing that I have noticed is that we do have a number of Africans also coming for this beatification.
That was going to be my next question. Do you know how many?
Well, up to now, I mean, directly, there are more than we have received directly. But we've received a couple of hundreds of group, I mean, hundreds of pilgrims that are going to be taking part from Africa, from Nigeria, from Ghana, from Kenya, from Uganda, and from other countries as well.
The church has been at pains to stress that this is a free event. You don't need a ticket to get into St. Peter's Square. Are you saying that because there have been a lot of cases of ticket touts who are trying to sell false tickets?
Well, absolutely. The thing is this, as you know, Rome is a very particular place, and every now and then you find somebody who wants to take advantage of these situations. But the church has a very clear policy. I mean, you don't need to pay to pray. So if you're coming for a Mass, you should be able to get into the Mass free of charge. And I think we need to insist on that point, because it is true that some people have tried, perhaps even in a very indirect way, to insinuate that buying certain services, the Mass is also included. So they're not exactly selling an entrance to the Mass, but they're kind of, I mean, insinuating.
Well, one thing, we were talking about the cost and about that the authorities, the church, is not asking the government to underwrite the cost, and you're hoping for sponsors. But do we have any idea of what the total cost could be of staging this event?
Well, we have calculated the cost to be around 3 to 4 euros per person for the weekend. So multiply that by the number of people who will turn up, that will give us the total number.
You're not. I mean, people aren't frightened that the church is going to be left with a big bill on its hands.
No, absolutely not. We have found, I mean, many good-hearted and good-willing organizations that are already supporting us, and we're also going to launch a little campaign for the faithful. I mean, if people want, I mean, they can actually even through the internet or whatever donate their 1 or 2 euros or whatever to help us. And like at the end of the day, we really have to believe in God's providence.
I was speaking to Father Cesar Attuire of Opera Romana Pellegrinaggi, the Vatican institution in charge of organising the beatification event. It's selling like hot cakes. Yes, I'm talking about Pope Benedict's latest book in his Jesus of Nazareth series that has climbed to the number 5 spot on the New York Times bestseller list in the US. Covering the Holy Week period from the entrance into Jerusalem to the resurrection, the Pope's new book has also made the bestseller lists of other US publications and has garnered enthusiastic reviews from many sources, both within and outside the Catholic Church. Obviously, a book written by a reigning pope is bound to create waves in the literary world. But over and above that, why is it proving so popular among such a wide range of readers? And to quote from one review, what are some of those astonishingly fresh spiritual perspectives it brings to the figure of Jesus? Father Robert Barron is an acclaimed author, speaker and theologian in the US, and is also the founder of Word on Fire Catholic Ministries, whose website draws over 1 million visitors a year from every continent. He's among those who have read and written a review on the Pope's book, and says he's not at all surprised at its popularity.
I'm not too surprised. Pope Benedict writes in a very lucid way, very accessible way. Though he's a top-flight scholar, His writing is very accessible and even poetic at times, so I'm not too surprised that people are responding to it.
And what kind of feedback have you received from other people you know you've come into contact with in the U.S. who have read his book?
The feedback I've heard has been very positive. You know, scholars read the book because they know Joseph Ratzinger is an important theologian, but I think average people read it because they find it very inspiring. And it's really written in the manner of a homily, I would say. And so it's like a good homily that lifts you up, inspires you, informs you. And that's the feedback I've been hearing from people, is that they find it very accessible and uplifting spiritually.
So you're saying there's a lot of ordinary men and women out there reading it, not just the theologians, not just the Catholic clergy and the people who you'd expect to be reading it.
Absolutely. And also people outside the Catholic Church. I think any Christian finds this book rather compelling. I've heard a number of Protestant scholars who say it's one of the best books on Jesus in the past 50 years. And so for a non-Catholic to say that, that's rather impressive. But it doesn't surprise me, given the kind of lyrical quality of the book.
And what about non-believers? Are many of them reading it? And if so, what has it got for them? What challenge does it give them?
I don't know. I mean, I haven't heard directly about atheists or non-believers reading it. But again, it wouldn't surprise me, because the gospel has its own convincing power. I think when you lay it out the way Pope Benedict does, even for someone who's outside the church, outside the faith, there's something compelling about it. So that wouldn't surprise me if they find it interesting, but I've not heard directly if they're responding to it.
Have you heard of any particular remarks that people have said, people who've read it, that are really stuck in your mind, or some particularly interesting reviews about it that you thought, oh, yes, that's true?
Yeah, well, the one that I just mentioned about the Protestant scholar saying it's the best book on Jesus in the past 50 years, that really stayed in my mind.
And why did he think it was the best? What were the reasons he was giving for that?
I think it was because it is so biblical and theological. So a Protestant will respond, of course, to the biblical quality of it, that he's not leaping away from the scriptural text, spending a lot of time with it, and he's bringing to bear all of his theological training. I think that combination he found especially compelling.
Now, you wrote a review about the book. What, in your mind, were the fresh spiritual perspectives that Pope Benedict brings to this book, and of course the fresh theological perspectives?
I'll take the second one first. I think Pope Benedict has been impatient with a way of approaching the Bible we've used for the past maybe 50 years, called the historical critical method. The purpose of that method is simply to uncover the intention of the authors of the scripture, to go back to that time to find out what they were intending to say to their audiences. Now, nothing in the world wrong with that, but here's the danger with it if you stress it too much. It can lock the Bible in the past. So if all we're doing is recovering what was in the minds of Isaiah or of Matthew or Mark, we can lock the gospel or the Old Testament back in that period. Pope Benedict reads it in the manner of the church fathers. Think of Augustine or Origen or John Chrysostom or even Thomas Aquinas. They're trying to read the Bible in a way that makes it very vibrant and relevant to our own time, because they read it in a spiritual way. So it did address the people of that time, but it also addresses us now and our deep spiritual concerns. Pope Benedict knows how to do that. I think that's the power of what he's done.
What, for you, were your favorite segments or the most fascinating segments, and why?
To me, it was his way of recovering the power of the temple. A lot of scholars are doing that right now, and Pope Benedict is one of them. You can't really understand Jesus without understanding the very rich Old Testament background, but especially around the temple, the place where sacrifice was made. So Pope Benedict reads the cross of Jesus as a great sacrifice that puts an end to the temple sacrifices and now lifts them up to a new level. I found the way he recovered the Old Testament theology of the temple and then showed how the cross of Jesus puts that to an end, if you want, or brings it to fulfillment. That, to me, was the most fascinating part of the book.
What are some of the most searching questions the Pope is asking in his book? And does he provide the answers, or does he just leave it as a question for the reader?
No, I think Pope Benedict sees Jesus Christ as the answer to the question in the human heart, the question of human life. What's it about? What's joy? What gives me satisfaction? That's the question everyone has, believer, non-believer, anybody. And he's convinced the Gospels say Jesus Christ is that answer, because he's the answer of the divine love. What we want, finally, is the divine life, which is love. Jesus is the embodiment of that, and we see it most fully in the cross and the resurrection. And so that's the gospel. It's the essential thing, but it's the answer to the question in every single human heart. Now, he learned that from his master, St. Augustine. Pope Benedict is very Augustinian, And Augustine famously said, Lord, our hearts are restless till they rest in thee. That, I think, is the central question that Benedict both asks and answers.
Now, this book is, of course, about Holy Week, and Holy Week begins in a few days from now. What advice would you give to anybody embarking upon reading the Pope's book during this particular period leading up to Easter?
Yeah, I think you're right. It's a very good book to read during Holy Week because it's a liturgical book. It follows the liturgical pattern. Another great master for Pope Benedict is Hans Urs von Balthasar, the Swiss theologian who died in 1988. And his whole theology is a theology of the Paschal Mystery, a theology of Holy Week. So I think Benedict is offering that book really for our spiritual meditation on Holy Thursday, Good Friday, Holy Saturday, Easter Sunday. If you have the time and you have the patience, I would say bring that book with you through the Holy Week time, and even with the liturgies of Holy Week in mind. I think it's a very helpful way to guide our meditation.
Okay, just to sum up, what lasting contribution do you think this book leads? You know, we've had so many books, obviously, on the figure of Jesus.
You know, my mother saw the book a few weeks ago. I brought it home, and she said, well, why another book on Jesus? And my mother's a good Catholic, a strong believer, loves the Pope. But it's a fair question. You know, there have been, as you say, thousands of books on Jesus. What's new about this one? I think it is that methodological issue I raised earlier, that Pope Benedict is giving us the whole Jesus. The danger is that a lot of the different methods will give you one aspect. They'll isolate one dimension. I think he has this great gift, the Church Fathers had it too, of bringing the whole Jesus to bear. The Jesus of history, yes indeed. The Jesus coming out of the Old Testament, yes indeed. The Jesus illumined by the spiritual and theological tradition, all of it. I think that's the great contribution, and I think he will set theology in a different direction with this book.
I was speaking to Father Robert Barron, author, speaker, and theologian, and founder of the Word on Fire Catholic Ministries in the U.S. Nearly 900 adults in the Diocese of Westminster, London, are about to take the final step in their journey to become Catholics at this year's Easter Vigil. But what are the reasons that motivate these people to take this important step, and what difference is it making to their lives? Christina Smith is an accountant in her 30s from London. She shares with us her story of why she felt drawn to Catholicism.
Well, it's quite a long story and been stretching over many years. I was brought up in a non-church-going family, and at the age of 7 I had a Catholic teacher who actually told us about Jesus, how much he loved us and how he died for us. Then, as time went on, I actually went to a Catholic secondary school, even though I'm an Anglican, and that was a really good experience as well. When I got a bit older, I actually went away from the church because I wanted to be a cool teenager and not go to church. And I thought that I could still have my faith. But what I actually found was not being in a community, I wasn't praying anymore. And lo and behold, I felt quite alone. So as I got a bit older, I knew that something was missing in my life. And I actually went back to the Anglican church and I went on an Alpha course, which was a good way of introducing who Christ was and all the things I had forgotten. Got involved with that, got involved with evangelism, which I discovered I had a passion for. And then not so long ago, I felt that God was calling me to Catholic evangelism. So I followed that. And in getting to know some Catholics, I felt that I really wanted to become Catholic myself. And I found out that it was easy, actually, to become a Catholic. I thought it was going to be a long, drawn-out process of 10 years and having to get to know various priests. So that's really my journey in a nutshell.
Another of the candidates preparing to be received into the Catholic Church is Stefan Seddon. A law clerk who works in London, he talks about how he experimented with several different religions and even dabbled in the occult before he finally found what he was looking for in the Catholic Church.
I was brought up as a Methodist. I was never baptised, but I attended Sunday school from about the age of 4 to about 9 years old. When I was 9, I started playing football on a Sunday. So obviously I gradually went away from the church, but I always kept a sort of link there. At senior school, I attended a Christian fellowship where I learnt quite a bit about the Bible study and various other things, but I never actually attended Sunday Mass or Sunday service. I sort of lost my way a bit gradually over time, and as I got older, I began to look into other religious systems. I looked into Buddhism, Islam, even some aspects of the occult, but I always felt that there was something wrong going that direction, and that I felt that I needed to be in the church. It was just which church I should belong to. Much later in life, and when I started doing a BA in History and Archaeology at Birkbeck University in London, I started to study early Christianity, and it's through my study of early Christianity that I got to learn a lot more about the Catholic Church and my journey to try and find the link back to Jesus' church, I found through my study. So basically it's through studying that I found that I believe the Catholic Church is a true Christian church.
But how has their conversion to Catholicism changed them as a person and their views on life? Let's hear from Christina and then Stefan again.
Well, what I've discovered actually is more discipline. The Catholic Church is really steeped in liturgical prayer and practice. So I have been discovering more of a discipline in praying and in observing within Lent, say, fasting, and just really getting into connection with that.
Definitely. I mean, as I said, I used to look into some of the aspects of the occult, which I don't do anymore. I was interested in ghosts and fortune telling and various other things. I find myself now attending Mass on every Sunday and trying to have a much deeper prayer life than I had before. I mean, in the old days, I used to pray when I wanted something. Now I pray sort of every day just to thank God for the day.
Embracing a new church can often spark a variety of reactions from family and friends of the convert. But Christina says most of hers have respected her decision.
Well, then my dad was baptised Catholic, and my mum is Anglican. Actually, she became a Christian when I was 10. So I have a Christian family, and at the moment their reaction is one of slight confusion, I suppose, because they're trying to understand why I feel the need to be received into the Catholic Church. But they do support me, and my friends' reactions are varied depending on, I have some friends that don't have any faith, so they don't ask me so many questions. And my friends who are from other denominations, again, I suppose they're just trying to understand why I feel the need to do this. But they do support me. And I feel actually that in time, by just observing why I'm doing this, that's the best way to answer them, really, rather than trying to force this on them. So I'd say they support me, but they have questions as well.
But what does Catholicism give a convert that other faiths cannot provide? Let's end with Stefan.
It gives me a link to the past, to the apostolic succession, to the apostles, to Jesus, to what was actually talked way back in the first century AD. And I'm a great believer in trying to get back to the source of the religions and trying to get back to the true teachings. Through studying St. Augustine in one of my essays, I found that the church, the Catholic Church, hasn't changed a lot since then. So it's the link with the past and the fact that we still believe the same things now as we did then.
I was speaking to Stefan Seddon, and earlier you heard the voice of Christina Smith, two people from London about to be received into the Catholic Church at the forthcoming Easter Vigil. As a self-confessed overeater at times, Scottish Jesuit priest Father Chris Bowles ponders on how we can curb our appetites during this season of fasting. Let's listen to the latest of his Lenten reflections.
One of the nice things about doing reflections on radio rather than in person or on film is that only the voice and the words matter. I don't know about you, but I can sometimes get distracted by a speaker in a lecture or a conference or even at the homily in Mass. Take myself, for example. I use big hand gestures, and sometimes people tell me they're a distraction. So I really do try to keep my hands at my side, but they seem to have a life of their own. And before long, off they go, flying and flapping all over the place. So you don't get that problem on Vatican Radio. And neither do we see the size and the shape of the speaker. And again, believe me, for you, this is a blessing. I'm not exactly slim, and in fact, I'd more truthfully be described at best as chunky, and I'm certainly overweight. I know myself well enough and can be honest enough to recognise that my weight has a direct connection to greed, a connection to overeating. I'm not good at controlling my appetite, and this troubles me a great deal. Each year in this wonderful season of Lent, each of us gets the opportunity to pay special attention to our appetites, precisely because many of us struggle in the same way. And when I speak of appetites, I don't just mean food. A lot of people have no difficulty with food at all. And of course, far from struggling with overeating, all too many people in the world don't even have enough to eat. But food is not the only appetite that we satisfy in our lives. It's not the only appetite we overindulge. Lent invites us to a period of fasting. And what's fasting if it's not a time to control our appetites, whatever they may be? So if, like me, your appetite is for food, can it be controlled? Can it be reduced? If our appetite is to collect and hoard and have more and more, can it be modified? If our appetite is to view television so that our entire day, or at least our evening, is spent in front of the box, could we turn off for a while and do something more constructive with the time? Maybe use it to spend time as a family, talking, praying, sharing the day. If our appetite's for gossip, can we determine not to listen to it, or not to ask questions about others that give rise to the gossip in the first place? No doubt, there are a whole host of other appetites out there, all being overindulged, all part of the Lenten invitation to fast, to pray, and to give. If we can all do some work in controlling our appetites, I'm sure that we will learn a lesson about what is essential in our life of faith. And it won't surprise us to know what it boils down to. It'll boil down to love, love of God through love of neighbour. So if you're still wondering even now what to do for Lent, why not take a look at your appetites? What are they, and how do you satisfy them? And most important of all, do they help you to love God through loving your neighbour? And if they don't, or if there's room for improvement, Lent is the ideal time to do whatever we need to do.
That was Father Chris Bowles, Superior of the Lauriston Jesuit Community in the Scottish capital of Edinburgh. That's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.